So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." When the man Elkanah went up with all his family to offer the annual sacrifice to the Lord and to fulfill his vow, Hannah did not go. She said to her husband, "After the boy is weaned, I will take him and present him before the Lord, and he will live there always." "Do what seems best to you," Elkanah, her husband, told her. "Stay here until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord make good his word." So the woman stayed at home and nursed her son until she had weaned him. After he was weaned, she took the boy with her, young as he was, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When they had slaughtered the bull, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, "As surely as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he shall be given over to the Lord." And he worshipped the Lord there. This is the word of the Lord.
Please do take a seat for our New Testament reading. The New Testament reading is taken from Luke chapter 15, verses 1 to 3, and 11b to 32, and can be found on page 1048 of your Bibles. "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.' Then Jesus told them this parable. 'There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one would give him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants, asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, come home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I have a confession for you this morning. I am terrible at asking for help. I don't know what it is. I have this kind of independent, I can do it streak in me. Whether it be carrying the shopping from the car and I'm like, well, I definitely can carry 5 plastic bags. I don't need to ask Lucy to help me. Or, if we're out driving and perhaps, unwittingly get lost. And Lucy's like, you could just stop and ask the guy on the corner. I'm sure he'll know. And I'm like, no, I will find my way. It may take a little bit longer, but we will get there and I will do it. I'm terrible at asking for help. But I don't think I've got anything compared to this guy. This is a gentleman, an Australian man called Eric Stewart. And in 2009, he became lost on an early morning drive to the shops and ended up almost 370 miles away from his starting point. Eric Stewart told police he failed to stop because he liked to drive. Eric was visiting friends in Yass, a country town south of Sydney in New South Wales. Mr. Stewart left to buy a newspaper on Monday morning, and more than 8 hours later, after taking a wrong turn on the highway, he asked Victoria State Police for help. He said, I just went on the road to have a drive, a nice, peaceful, quiet drive. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew it was somewhere, and with a bit of luck, I would eventually find my wife again, he said. He rejected the suggestion to get a satellite navigation system. Why would you want one of those, he said. You can't get lost. There's no fun in that. When we're lost, the best thing we can do, surely, is ask for help. And it's that idea that brings us to our New Testament reading, this famous reading of the lost son. But what I want to suggest to you this morning is that this is not a story of just one lost son, but two lost sons, both desperately in need of help. The only difference is that one comes to see it, whereas the other is blind to it. And the big idea I want to suggest to you is that this shows us that ultimately we all need help. Everyone needs help, from the worst sinner to the greatest saint. We are all in need of the grace of God. And that while the arts of Christian living, of following Jesus, the key to knowing joy in our relationship with him is to be constantly mindful of it. To be mindful of the grace of God. To never forget that. Each of us needs help. Each of us needs the grace of God. So let's turn to our gospel reading. This is the third in a series of parables that Jesus tells in response to the criticism he's getting from the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. You see, he's not spending time with them. He's spending time with tax collectors, with sinners, those who they look down upon. They're not the ones who do the right thing. They don't observe the law. They don't observe the ceremonial laws about purity. And Jesus, as is his way, doesn't sermonize. He doesn't preach at them. He doesn't argue theology. He tells a story, or tells stories in response. You've got the story of the lost coin, then the lost sheep. And then finally, our reading this morning, the story of the lost son or sons. The story begins with the youngest son going to his father with the outrageous request for his share of the inheritance. Father, give me my share of the estate. Think about this for a moment. If you have a son or don't have a son, imagine them coming to you right now, phoning you up this morning and saying, I've been thinking, Mum, Dad, you know what? I actually kind of want your money now, and I'd like you to sell your house and your bank account, clear it out, your pension fund, your shares. I want them now. It would be absolutely outrageous, wouldn't it? There might be some problems in your relationship. It might not be such a good thing. And this is what's happening here. And not just that, but there's all the things that we don't answer well. Culturally, that would have been such a cut against the grain. The expectation was that the sons would look after their parents in old age. And it would have brought shame on the family because they'd have to sell their estate, split it up. So it's not just affecting the individual relationships, it's affecting their standing within the community. And what the son is effectively saying to his father is, you mean nothing to me. I want your things, but I don't want you. I don't care about you or this family. So here we have this younger son, this rebellious, archetypal wild child, a free spirit who leaves home. And of course it's extreme, but we can see that tendency in ourselves sometimes, can't we? We want to get our own way, do our own thing. I was doing jigsaws with my daughter the other day. And as you know, when you do a jigsaw, you do the edges first, don't you? That's the sensible and wise thing to do. Otherwise, you just don't know where you are. Would she listen to me? No. She knows best. My three-year-old daughter was determined to do what she wanted to do. She knew best. And that tendency doesn't go away as we get older. Time and time again, I think I know best. I know what to do. I want to be in control of my own destiny. I want to shape my own future, make my own choices about what I do and where I do it. And when, as we get older, those affect others more and more, don't they? Those choices we make affect other people, just as it does here. The younger son's choice to ask for his share of the estate, as I said, would have brought shame on his family. And the story goes on that the younger son ends up squandering it all, as we know. He blows it all, ends up feeding pigs. The ultimate shame for a Jew. End up feeding pigs. Longing for their food. And maybe those listening, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, thought, oh, that's great. He's getting what he deserved now. Well done, Jesus, actually. No, you're on it there. Ha ha. The story continues. The younger son is far from home, but as he hits rock bottom, he decides to go home. He sees he needs help. He decides to go home to beg for mercy. He can't be a son anymore, but maybe he'd be accepted back as a servant. And then again, I can imagine, you know, those are thinking, ha-ha, when he gets back home, Jesus, you know, the father's going to condemn him, isn't he? Give him what for? Make sure that he's learned his lesson. Because he's got it completely wrong. The son has blown it big time. And can you imagine their surprise? That you know, we're really familiar with this parable now. But their surprise of the teachers and the Pharisees, teachers of law and the Pharisees, as they hear the response of the father. When instead of harsh words and condemnation, upon his arrival home, we get this incredible picture of reconciliation. The father, the one who's been shamed, who's been hurt, abused, has been watching and waiting for his son to return. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Now, as many of you know, I like to run. I run around Richmond Park a couple of times a week. And you know, fairly often I'll see, shall we say, a gentleman or a lady, more senior in years, running. It's, you know, it happens occasionally. But in first century Israel, that just didn't happen. A man of the father's status would not run. But the joy and delight that he feels can't be contained. He runs to embrace his son. The son starts his speech, but he's not even able to finish it. Because the son stops him, calls his servants to bring a robe, to prepare a feast, puts a ring on a finger. And this is crazy behavior. And the point that Jesus is making to Pharisees and teachers of the law is loud and clear. God's heart, God's passion is for those people I'm spending time with, those sinners, those tax collectors, those people you don't think are worthy. God's heart is for these people. He longs them to come home. And when they do, he's going to welcome them with open arms. God is looking for them. The picture of the running father is a picture that showed us the very heart and nature of God. A God who loves, who longs to forgive and welcome home lost children. And it's just possible this morning as we sit here that there are some of you who know that you are like the younger child. You're rebellious. You've got that independent streak. Maybe you know you've not lived as you should have done. It's like you're stuck in a maze. You go off, do your own thing, but you just don't know where home is. And God's invitation is to come home. And knowing that he's not a harsh schoolmaster who will delights in reprimanding you for your mistakes, but a loving father who runs to us to welcome us home. The younger son messes up, but he realizes his need of help, and in doing so, makes his way back home. The father embraces him and welcomes him home. But my guess is, being that we're here at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, in church, doing the right thing, that for many of us, we don't necessarily relate so much to the younger son. And it may just be the elder son. So let's have a look at him. He's on his way home from a hard day in the fields. He hears the celebrations and calls one of the servants to him to ask what's going on. And he is furious. He refuses to go into the house, forcing his father to come out to him, which in that culture, again, was a sign of absolute disrespect. You did not make your parents, your father, come to you. Absolute disrespect. It's effectively casting a vote of no confidence in his father's actions. But the father comes out and pleads with him to come in, and he refuses. His words: look at all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. It's not fair, is basically his point. It's not fair. A preacher once changed this story so that the father, instead of putting the ring and robe on the younger son, puts it on the elder brother and kills a fattened calf in honor of his years of service and obedience. And a woman stood up while he was preaching and yelled out, "That's the way it should have been written." And I don't know about you, but I can kind of see her point. I can kind of see the elder son's point. It's not fair. After all, he's done the right thing. He's been at home working in the fields, working hard. He's tried to honor his father. And what the father is doing is costly for him. It's literally cost him, because his brother is being brought back into the family, being made an heir again. The fact that a calf is being killed, that rings are being brought out, they're coming out of the elder son's inheritance. He's doing the sums and doesn't like the result. It's scandalous. But this is grace. This is grace. This is the grace of God. Undeserved forgiveness and restoration. And what the elder son has seemingly forgotten is that he is just as in need of help, of grace, as his younger brother. He seems to have forgotten that he can't earn what his father wants to give to him. His words: all these years I've been slaving for you and this never disobeyed your orders. He sees his work for his father as some sort of transaction. If I do this, if I work really hard, then I'm entitled to this. I earn it. So when he sees it being given away, understandably, he's infuriated. What he's earned is no longer his. But he's forgotten that he can't earn it. He doesn't need to earn it. His father will give it to him willingly. It's a gift. And I wonder this morning if we need to pay attention that here at 9 o'clock on a Sunday, we, if we're not careful, could fall into the same trap. We tend to divide the world, don't we, into good guys and bad guys. Those who do the right thing and those who really don't. Those who keep the law, who do, you know, what we expect of them. And those who go off their own way, rebellious, independent. And that's what the Pharisees and teachers of the law had done. They divided the world into the good guys and the bad guys. But what Jesus is saying is that you all need help. You all need grace and forgiveness. You all need me. And for us today, I think he'd say, you can't earn my love by coming to church on a Sunday, by reading your Bible every day, by praying, by fasting, by serving the poor, by coming along to the big clean. That, you can't earn it. It doesn't work like that. And if those things are motivated by a sense that you can earn them, then actually, you've got it wrong. And that's sin, that's rebellion. That's misunderstanding who I am. The truth is, whether we're more like the younger brother or the older one, we all need help. Whether we rebel and go off living our own way, or whether we come to church 4 times on a Sunday, pray, fast, we all need help. A newspaper once wrote to a number of prominent authors of the time, asking what they thought was wrong with the world. One writer, G.K. Chesterton, responded, and his response was simple, 2 words, I am, I am. And we can so easily forget that. As we come along to church, for years of following Jesus, none of us are qualified. None of us can change our status in our own strength by doing good things. We're all ultimately just beggars telling other beggars where to find bread. None of us are entitled to the grace and welcome of God. It's always a gift. We're all what's wrong with the world. But God is the gracious Father who longs to embrace us, to forgive us, to welcome us home. Sometimes I think as followers of Jesus, we can become overfamiliar with the gospel. Too close to it almost. It's like we forget its power. Imagine, if you will, being given unprecedented access to Sistine Chapel. And they put a scaffold up for you so you can go wherever you want. You can spend hours alone in there just staring at the wonderful pictures. And you climb the scaffold to get a closer look. And you get up there and you spend a few hours on your back maybe, just lying and pondering. And you get looking closer and closer. But after a while, you kind of get bored. You kind of like, well, I'm so close to it now. It's a finger. What's a finger? You decide to come down from the scaffold. That wasn't really worth it, was it? But then, as you come down to the floor again, you look up, your head's raised, and you see it in all its beauty and majesty. And again, you're like, wow, this is amazing. This is amazing. Sometimes we, for whatever reason, become overfamiliar, too close, and we lose what God has done for us. The extravagant love lavished on each one of us, saint and sinner alike. Let's not forget the wonder of the gospel. Because the tragedy of this story is that it ends up with the eldest son on the outside looking in. Rembrandt's famous picture, he's on the right there. Just looking on, begrudging perhaps the welcome that the younger brother has been given. But he's on the outside. He's not experiencing joy, the joy that he could be his from relationship with his father. He could be part of the party, but he's not. He's on the outside looking in. His father's desperate to help. He comes outside to plead with him to come back in, but he won't. The truth is, whether we're more like the younger son or the older son, each of us needs the help of God. The challenge for us, I think, is how do we stay mindful of that? How do we stay conscious of that? How do we prevent ourselves becoming like the elder brother? On the outside, looking in. On the Great Plains of the USA, great blizzards can come out of nowhere. In a matter of minutes, conditions can become life-threatening. Because in a snowstorm, you can suddenly suffer a whiteout where you can't see anything. You can't see something that's 10 feet away. And so you don't know the way to safety, to shelter. You can be on your own land and end up freezing to death because you're unable to find your way home. And so there was a time when, at the first sign of a blizzard, farmers would run ropes from their back door out to the barns they needed to go to feed their animals. Because that way they knew they could always find their way home when the blizzard struck. If they're out in the barn and it suddenly hit, they could follow the rope back home. And just one idea this morning is that I believe that God gives us lots of different ropes. And one I want to focus on to help us find a way home, one I want to focus on, think about just as we finish this morning, is the practice of confession. Simply yet deliberately setting aside time to come back to God, to come before him in honesty. Because whenever we confess, we remind ourselves, we tether ourselves, we tie ourselves to the unceasing mercy and grace and welcome of God. Sometimes we might need to confess things we've done wrong. Other times we might need to confess that actually our attempts to do good things were motivated perhaps by an attempt to earn something in the eyes of God. Because I find it fascinating, isn't it? Both sons, I think, are lost. But the one who returns home, who repents, is the one who goes inside to the party and experiences the joy and the delight of that. And I believe that that shows us that one of the things that confession does is that it opens us up to experiencing and knowing the embrace of our Heavenly Father, to knowing the joy of forgiveness, the absolute joy that God takes in us. Every time we say sorry, we remind ourselves that we're all sinners. We're all what's wrong with the world. But we are saved by grace and by grace alone. We've done nothing to deserve it. We all need help. We all need the grace of God. Grace is for the sinners, and grace is for the saints. The wonderful thing is that God is ready and waiting, desperate to give us the help we need. Whether we need help because we've wandered far from home, or whether we're like the older son, outside looking in. God longs to welcome us home, to that celebration, to knowing the embrace, the delight, the joy that God takes in repentant sinners. Amen.